This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Rhetoric is a word in disrepute. It's usually used in the pejorative, as in the phrase mere rhetoric. In his new book, linguist John McWhorter argues that we now take it to mean an oral snow job. For millennia, though, rhetoric used to refer to the art and science of persuasion, the combination of logic and language used in debates and speeches. To McWhorter, the change of meaning symbolizes an important change in our relationship with the English language. As one example, he cites the differences in speeches delivered by Presidents John F. Kennedy and George W. Bush. We're going to listen to a couple of excerpts. Here's President Kennedy, referring to communism during his State of the Union address in 1961. Leave the politics aside as you listen, and listen to the prose.
Our task is to convince them that aggression and subversion will not be profitable routes to pursue these ends. Open and peaceful competition for prestige, for markets, for scientific achievements, even for men's minds, is something else again. For if freedom and communism were to compete for man's allegiance in a world at peace, I would look to the future with ever-increasing confidence.
In keeping with the long tradition of oratory, John Kennedy's speechwriters took great care with vocabulary, with rhythm and craftsmanship. President Kennedy was speaking highly polished English. Contrast that to President Bush, who John McWhorter argues is talking. This from the State of the Union address earlier this year.
Now, in this century, the ideology of power and domination has appeared again and seeks to gain the ultimate weapons of terror. Once again, this nation and all our friends are all that stand between a world at peace and a world of chaos and constant alarm. Once again, we are called to defend the safety of our people and the hopes of all mankind. And we accept this responsibility.
John McWhorter joins us now from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco, and it's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
Describe for us what you hear in those two excerpts and why it's so important.
Well, the difference is that Kennedy was speaking in a time when there was a cultural assumption that when you used language in public, you dressed it up, you decorated it, you did something quite different from what we do when we speak, which in itself is okay. That is much less of a sense that we have today, and our current president's speeches are certainly not exactly the way one talks or the way he talks. However, there's less of a sense of it being a decorative occasion, less of a sense of every word and every phrase having been honed like glass. And that's because we live in an era where I think since the late 1960s, we've developed a sense that to dwell too much in the artifice of crafting and polishing language too far beyond what it is in its casual sense signifies the phony, signifies getting away from the individual and the spontaneous, and things that we've come to value. And it creates a very different linguistic culture than one that existed until just about 35 years ago.
In his new book, Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should, Like, Care, John McWhorter writes about the demise of formality, not just in speech, but across the board in American culture. He ascribes it, as you just heard, to a particular moment in history, the late 1960s, and to the triumph of the counterculture of that time. It's a provocative argument. If you'd like to agree or take issue, the phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the conversation, we'll focus on poetry and music. But, John McWhorter, let's stick to political speech for the moment, to oratory to begin with. At several points in this book, you describe examples of the old style of high English as windy, pretentious, purple, baroque, corny, and starched, and I could go on. Isn't the modern style a simpler, cleaner, less artificial prose?
Yes, I mean, that can also be said. The book is not a very cranky book, and I think that there's many good things about the fact that we're a little bit more come-as-you-are linguistically as there are bad things. And indeed, especially if you go back before Kennedy to speeches that were made before amplification, then you get a kind of a prose which is quite crafted and rather impressive in that, but also is rather purple and bloviatory that we can barely read today. And I don't think that there would be any need in going back to that. That was just a certain kind of fashion. However, the fact is that even after amplification, there was a time when one could make a speech that was designed to persuade and that was designed to respond to possible counter-objections, and where the sense that one had, that you see in old movies when somebody's going to make a speech and they go, and they sit down and they spend the night writing, that sense of what making a speech is had its value, because that kind of speech is not only pretty, but it's a good vehicle for sustaining an extended argument and for possibly changing minds. That's what our public discourse should be about. It is less so to the extent that we distrust that kind of hyper-preparation.
Just to make it clear, I mean, you're not talking about poor grammar, which a lot of people care about.
No, this is not about Billy and me went to the store, or, you know, whether or not you begin a sentence with and. Casual speech is fine, as I've written in various books. There's no such thing as a person without some sort of mental defect who is running around using bad grammar. But then there is written language, which is an artifice upon spoken language. It's something that can only happen if there's writing that allows you to reflect. Then you can learn to speak in that written way, but it requires the existence of the writing. And there are good things about that, too. So non-standard language is wonderful, but there's also something to the artifice of the written formal pole. And it seems to me that the place for that is marginalizing the society, and I find that fascinating. There are problems with it, there are good things about it, but I think it's also something that defines us as a people right now.
And you point out that it is about us as a people, it's not necessarily about the modern world, that in other languages, other cultures, there are means by which people have this sort of high version of their language.
Oh, yeah, it's uniquely focused here, and there are analogs of this elsewhere, but you do see things such as that you can take aside a Russian undergraduate, and no matter how much of a normal, basically American teenager they've become, you can say, recite some Pushkin, and bam, they're reciting Pushkin. And this is something that we really don't have in our American students. Or in Great Britain right now, there's a radio show, BBC radio show, where one of the things that they do is that they challenge each other to orate for 60 seconds on some topic. Say, you know, what happened when I became 35? How do you catch trout in Quebec? Or something like that. And they do it.
Some without repetition or hesitation, to boot.
Precisely. And the thing is, that's hard to imagine here. And no offense, I love NPR, but even on NPR, it's hard to imagine us doing that here in America. We're not as fascinated by English as the Brits are.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go with Tom, who joins us from Boulder, Colorado.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Great. I just wanted to make the point that this is certainly not a new issue. And if you take a look at Socrates, he certainly had the issue with the orator Gorgias, who could argue a point on either side and win, all in the delivery and in the polish of his prose, without caring about the substance. And I think that us getting away from the polished prose is us trying to deal with issues on a more personal level that we can understand with.
Socrates against the sophists of the time.
Exactly.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that, except that just as you can dissimulate with highly crafted language, I think it's equally possible to do it with less crafted language. One thinks of Billy Sunday or Huey Long or all sorts of ways that the short and the punchy can be used to distract people from a truth. So I very much take the point, but I think that there are risks in all levels of language.
Thanks for the point, Tom.
Sure thing.
Why do you pin it specifically on the 1960s? Why is that the hinge of change here?
Well, there were obviously precursors, and so in terms of oratory in particular, it gets toned down several notches once there's a microphone. The way that a William Jennings Bryan spoke was partly conditioned by the fact that he had to be heard by thousands of people outside. It had to be a kind of a theatrical performance. But in general, in all of the areas of this development that I discuss in the book, you see a particular phase shift, as it were, in the late 1960s. And so, for example, if you read Newton Minow's Vast Wasteland speech, where he indicts television in 1961, The second you read the speech, it has the feeling of something from that time when everything was in black and white and everybody smoked. You feel it as an old-fashioned speech. That's 61. Then you go to 72, and you start looking at speeches starting in that particular time, and all of a sudden they seem modern. For example, in the book, I use Jane Fonda's speech over Radio Hanoi against the Vietnam War, and she's saying very important things, but in a way that we recognize as the come-as-you-are kind of English. You also see it in journalistic writing. Major shift at that time. You see it in various trends in education. Something happens in that fascinating period between about 1964 and 1970. Although, of course, way back in the 50s, the Beats were doing all these things. But the difference is that they were a fringe movement. It's in the late 60s that this sort of thing becomes mainstream.
And you also point out in the book some of this was going on in the 20s as well. Let's get another caller on the line. Judith joins us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm concerned that the original example was comparing Kennedy with George W. Bush, and I just have to wonder if the distinction there is about a change in the times or if it's about a personal linguistic style. And I think it may be, I'd be curious to know if we would see as much of a difference between Kennedy and Clinton.
John McCoy,
I would.
Better command of the English language.
Yeah, Clinton is definitely an articulate person. But here's the difference, and I think this is partly cultural and partly the way the speeches are written. I'm not sure that there's a famous Clinton speech. One could single some out as having been better than the others, but what we remember him most for saying, unfortunately, has to do with things surrounding the Monica Lewinsky incident. Whereas with Kennedy, you have these ringing phrases that seem to come down through time. So Clinton himself probably was a more articulate man off the cuff than Kennedy actually was, because, of course, Kennedy was reading things that Sorensen and the others wrote.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's interesting that Clinton was not situated in a culture where we would expect him to make take-home speeches. He spoke well, but he was after a certain time.
Judith, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We mentioned a moment ago William Jennings Bryan. He, of course, was a master of the older style of oratory. Let's listen to the peroration of his famous Cross of Gold speech in Chicago.
The great cities are in favor of the gold standard. We reply that the great cities rest upon our broad and fertile prairies. Burn down your cities and leave our farms, and your cities will spring up again as if by magic. But destroy our farms, and the grass will grow in the streets of every city of the country. If they dare to come out in the open field and defend the gold standards, the good thing, we will answer their demand by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
The boy orator of the Platte, going back to 1896, three-time Democratic presidential nominee, William Jennings Bryan.
Notice how that swept you along. Yeah.
Now, is that what you want us to do? Is that the way you lecture your classes at Berkeley?
We can't do that because he was delivering that. Of course, that was in a studio much later on. But
yes,
he was delivering that outdoors, and so it had to be a kind of a theater. Nevertheless, that guy had to sit down and scratch that stuff out. It took such care. He was by no means being come as you are. He wasn't just talking. What's interesting about Bryan is that a lot of his contemporaries said that he wasn't any genius himself. He was not a great man mentally. He just had a particular knack for that kind of oration and composing them, which shows that it's a particular skill that is no longer valued. You can be brilliant, you cannot be, but something is lost, and it distinguishes us. Ordinary people loved listening to that guy.
We're speaking with John McWhorter about his new book, Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music, and Why We Should Like Care. We'll be discussing the change and lack of formality in our language in terms of poetry and also in terms of music later in the program. You can join the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later this hour, we'll be talking about the epic construction of Rockefeller Center, the men who shaped it, and the way it has shaped New York City. Right now, we're talking with John McWhorter about what he sees as the degradation of the English language since the midpoint of the 20th century. And I wanted to ask you an email question we got from MT in Boston. I hope Mr. McWhorter has paid attention to the extent that formal rhetoric started to be associated with insincerity and deception. We grew not to trust it after its tropes and forms helped to ease us into Vietnam.
I would agree completely. And what happens is that there's the countercultural movement on college campuses, there's the protest against the Vietnam War, there's the civil rights movement, all those things. I think few of us would think that those were not good things. But there was a byproduct because language had been used to deceive us so much. And I think also for the more general reason that there was a philosophical shift towards seeking our inner muse and the spontaneous. This traces back to the Romantics, but I think it was uniquely focused at this point. We ended up distrusting the kind of externally imposed norms of that high language. But certainly, I think that there's a causal relationship between the political issues of the time and what happened to our language culture.
Let's go now to Butch, who's with us from DePaul, Indiana.
How are you doing?
All right.
I want to talk about a somewhat different angle. Well, first, let me tell you, I live in southern Indiana, which was populated by this particular area by the Irish. And the use of the language goes like, I hadn't did that, and I ain't went there. Even had a gal working for me one time, says, I ain't and did that. So I'm listening to someone from Ireland who's come here to try to get money for the IRA, and he used the language, the English language, in exactly the same way that I think it has evolved in this little part of the world. So that might be degradation according to usage, but in fact, that's the way it evolved through the community.
I'm not sure that's John McWhorter's argument, but go ahead,
John. There's a very important distinction. There's spoken language and there's written.
What I really want to talk about is...
And what you're talking about is spoken language.
Yes, but in the written language, in the speech writing, etc., I think there is distinct danger of someone who is able to speak a thought very well, misleading the listener. Because he said it well, and said it with a wonderful voice, and said it with the proper dramatics, can lead you down the wrong path. I was listening to a Methodist preacher one time who had a big booming voice, and he made an impassioned plea for our souls. When I broke down the things that he said, he sounded great, but I didn't really agree with him.
Yeah, that's certainly true. But as I said before, that's definitely a fact with high language, if you want to call it that. But you can also do that with casual language. You can be a person who is supposed to be in a serious position or presenting oneself as a candidate for a serious position. And you can pepper your statements with various jokes and little sallies that kind of go to the gut and perhaps have a certain vernacular or even ethnic flavor. And as a result, you go down as having been a great speaker and as having made a lot of wonderful points, when really, if you took a look at a transcript of what the person said, it really wasn't a whole lot. I think what you're talking about is the nature of language rather than high language in particular.
Well, one of the other points you make is going on from prose and oratory to poetry. And let's listen, for example, to Robert Frost reading a bit of his poem, The Road Not Taken, this from 1956.
I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
And contrast that, a formal approach, with Laurie Schmidt reciting her poem Our Mark nearly 40 years later.
The smell of sizzling ribs floating through the sweaty air. Nothing, nothing, nothing going on for me and my friends. No work, no park, no nothing. Way it is in my tireless, treeless hood. Nothing going down. We make our own thrill.
Now, we don't mean to necessarily contrast Laurie Schmidt with Robert Frost. We're meaning to contrast their styles and their use of language and the way that they construct their poems. Talk a little bit about the differences, John.
Well, what's interesting is that there was a time when the kind of poetry where you had strict meter and very close rhymes occupied a larger space. It wasn't that all poetry was written that way, but even when it wasn't, there was a sense of what Judith Shulevitz has called constraint in the way one wrote a poem. And what this was an equivalent of this written formal language, something that is not at all like speech. You don't talk like Edna St. Vincent Millay wrote poetry. You couldn't. It would be mentally impossible. Whereas what we just heard, that kind of poetry is certainly poetry, and that isn't exactly the way you talk either. But obviously, it's much closer to the spoken. It's trying to summon that. And the nature of that art is that there is less of the almost heartless constraint, in the sense that I used it before, that used to be considered ordinary. And I think that that's another symptom of our shift towards a more spontaneous, immediate approach to language, rather than the trick of making it something completely different.
Some would say more authentic, more real.
And they would be right in many ways. There are certain things that an Edna St. Vincent Millay could not quite convey. And so certainly, with the kind of poetry that we just heard, a wider swath of reality comes out. And I think that that's good in many ways. There are ways in which older arts can be dismayingly uptight. That even includes the wonderful old American pop songs. Nevertheless, it's still interesting that, say, an Edna St. Vincent Millay could write letters where she casually assumed that poetry rhymed tight and had meter that was strict, and that then there was other kinds of poetry. Whereas today, that would be a rather peculiar sentiment to assume, and many people who first start writing poetry do not assume that they're supposed to rhyme tightly and have it have TikTok Dr. Seuss meter. We have a freer sense of what poetry is, and that's part of what marks our times.
And another thing that marks our times is that poetry is a great deal less important in our culture than it used to be.
Yeah, I always say that it's kind of like marjoram in the spice rack. You know, it's one of those things that you might have, but a lot of people don't like it, and many people haven't even heard of it. And it's not that back in the day everybody was running around reciting Frost, but poetry had more juice in the culture. You had little snippets of doggerel that were in newspapers. Or if you think about it, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas became a big hit. Today, that couldn't happen in any venue. No poem would acquire that kind of stranglehold upon us, because poetry just occupies a different place for us. And especially if you were a middle-class educated person, you likely had an anthology of poetry. You had some poetry on your shelf. You had to be able to fake it. It wasn't for nothing that at the beginning of one Bugs Bunny cartoon, he's reciting Longfellow. And think about it. Why is this rabbit reciting Longfellow? It was assumed that you had been drilled in it in school.
Mm-hmm. And the faking it part reminds me of so many English classes.
Let's face it. Yeah.
Anyway, one of the things you talk about, though, in your book is that anthropologists say that one thing that is universal about mankind, human beings, is mm-hmm. poetry.
Yeah, there is no such thing, as far as is known, as a people where there's nothing that we would put under that rubric. And if you're studying even a language written by people who do not have literacy and don't read or write in their language, there is almost always a kind of champagne version of the language that they break out on ceremonial occasions that involves often very different words and just as often different ways of putting words together. And that's something that people sit enraptured as they listen to. I think that here in America, it could be said that we're becoming unique in our relative lack of interest in that, the way our interest in that is becoming a minority phenomenon rather than being something that has a central place in the culture the way it used to.
Hmm. One of the interesting arguments that John McWhorter makes in his book is, in fact, that popular music has taken on the role of poetry, at least in some respects. But he also talks about music in general, and the title of the book, or the subtitle, is, of course, The Degradation of Language and Music. So let's listen to a couple of examples of music and see what he's talking about, the loss of formality in there and what is changing and what we're losing. Take a listen now to Fred Astaire from 1932, a very young-sounding Fred Astaire, singing a part of Cole Porter's Night and Day.
Like the beat, beat, beat of the tom-tom when the jungle shadows fall. Like the tick, tick, tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating you.
Now, that sounds a little different from Tom Waits performing In the Neighborhood from his album Swordfish Trombones 50 years later.
While the eggs chase the bacon on the frying pan, the violin dog pigeons are the steeple bell rope, and the dog sniff the garbage bells over last night. And there's always construction work bothering you in the neighborhood.
John McWhorter, the first thing that jumps out at you is the differences between the diction there, well, night and day.
I'm glad you picked those two, because I actually like Tom Waits' music a lot. But that is a very good illustration of the difference. First of all, that night and day segment, especially that verse, that took a lot of work just to write that musically. That's one of those where imagine sitting down at the piano and coming up with it. You know, if you're a pianist, even faking that verse can be kind of tough with the musical structure. And then there's the very precise matching of the words syllable by syllable to the melodic line. Then there's Fred Astaire's voice, where Fred is singing the best he can. Astaire didn't have a great voice, but he's just doing what he does. He's not revealing a whole lot of himself. The Waits music, in contrast, is much more elementary. It's based more on repetition rather than changing what you do every four bars. And indeed, the soul of Waits is the persona that he comes up with, and that persona is one that you can imagine leaning on your kitchen sink drinking a beer. We thrill to that kind of thing. We've turned inwards. He's doing his own thing, Tom Waits. Fred Astaire was doing somebody else's thing.
And what does that change in formality tell us? Why is it significant?
Well, what's interesting is that we've moved from a society where, once again, it was like poetry. It's not that everybody loved it, but classical music occupied a much larger place in society back in the day. Again, the fact that it was parodied in cartoons shows that people were at least expected to get the joke. And classical music is written music in the sense that it couldn't exist without paper. This is not something that could be passed on from memory to memory, Beethoven's Seventh, for example. It used to be that this had a larger place in society. Melody and harmony were more what our grandparents and great-grandparents had their ears cocked towards. Nowadays, we tend more towards rhythm and rawness of vocal emotion. Those are very seductive things, and they can be done very well. But they also take less training. They take less work to learn how to appreciate. Those are things that, even as infants, we've been shown to respond to. And that's, again, an example of how we're going to the spontaneous, to what's inside of us, to nurturing what is natural about us, as opposed to dwelling in artifices and being shown something that takes a little bit more effort to grab onto, if one is to grab onto it at all. So that seems to parallel the trend in language and how we conceive of expression.
In his book, Doing Our Own Thing, John McWhorter writes, "The principle of least effort entices us all, and few revolutions have asked less of their adherents than the one that called for us to shed starchy formalities, scoff at authority, and have more sex." You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And Brian joins us from Sacramento, California.
Hi, I'm here.
Hello, Brian. Are you with us?
Here.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I am. Thank you. I've called before, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question and more of a comment about the content that comes across through advertising, et cetera. And the one specific is there's a commercial that they play in California for a major car company, where they use the phrase, "Californians go with the flow at their own pace." And I'm just wondering how much of the population doesn't recognize that those two phrases contradict each other.
Well, it seems to me that those phrases have been chosen because they have a certain sonority that has a kind of a genuineness and a dynamicness. I doubt if they were really thinking very much about the meaning, because the commercial was designed to just go by very quickly. It's kind of manipulation.
Yeah. Thanks, Brian.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Let's try Deanna, who's with us from Berkeley, California.
Yes, hi. This might be a more appropriate question for an earlier part of the conversation, but when you were talking about political speeches and the oratory styles, Mario Cuomo came to mind, and I was wondering if Mr. McWhorter could comment on his style and what makes him so effective. Is it his use of language or just his knack for public speaking?
That's a good point, because very often when you ask people, you know, can you name an oration in recent years, people will talk about the City on a Hill speech. But, you know, that was almost 20 years ago at this point, and that's what's interesting, that it would have been so rare and made such an impression. He did a beautiful job, old school job, as if he had been trained in rhetoric in school, which perhaps he was. But if you had asked somebody in 1905, when's the last time you heard a take-home oration couched on that kind of level, they would have said, oh, 2 weeks ago when the vice mayor dedicated some boat. That was just what you were expected to do. Mm-hmm. Whereas for us, we always remember that, which now was a generation ago.
Okay. Deanna, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And let's try John. And John's in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Hey, Neil. Thanks for taking my call and
sure.
doing the program.
Thank you.
Every day. I just returned from a trip from the UK yesterday, actually, and wanted to just comment. And maybe I'm not getting what I just have this feeling that when you're in Great Britain that there's a preciseness to the language, and then you come back to the States and I guess we're using the terms, well, this is becoming more common and more comfortable and more the way that we talk here in the States, but there it's an enjoyable to listen to proper language being used, and perhaps we're just getting lazy here in the States over time. And I think back, you know, when you ask the great orators, Winston Churchill is perhaps Martin Luther King. I mean, what do you think? Maybe we're just getting lazy here in the States.
John?
Well, I would just offer the caveat that you go to a pub in Great Britain. I'm not sure how careful the speech is once we get beyond the pleasure that we happen to find in their vowels and their intonation, which I am not immune to. But nevertheless, it's interesting. I did a Google search with admire command of English language and just went boom. And I got about 85 hits. And out of the 85, all but six were either from people in Great Britain, or referring to people from Great Britain, that was the vast majority, or the few that were American, other than exactly six, were about people who were literally about 80 or over, or comments made by Americans 80 or over. In other words, people who had grown up squarely within another era. So there is a different sense of what English is and what English means there than here.
John McWhorter's new book is called Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should Like Care. John McWhorter, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
John McWhorter was with us from our studios of our member station in San Francisco, KQED. When we come back from a break, it was a land deal, an 11-acre land deal that rivaled the Louisiana Purchase and a construction project that's been compared to the pyramids, a story of high finance and low dealings with characters that range from Frida Kahlo to Benito Mussolini. Daniel Okrent joins us to talk about his new book on Rockefeller Center. If you have recollections or family stories about Rockefeller Center, give us a phone call. Our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.